store that was down on the waterfront has a piece of ice in it that's the size of a semi-truck and trailer inside the store building.
Eagle residents start dealing with flood devastation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 1st of June. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a look at the petroleum potential in the Arctic.
For the Arctic nations, the resources we're talking about here are quite significant.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed, on the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
Eagle residents have started the long cleanup process after record ice jam flooding destroyed much of the interior community this spring. APRN's Lori Townsend is there to get a sense of the damage and the rebuilding process. She says large blocks of ice are still stranded on land at the old village site.
Folks are telling me about three quarters of it's gone, which is hard to believe because the chunks are still massive, you know, thousands, tons of ice. But it looks like a war zone. Trees are completely sheared off. There's a small island that's visible from the old village area, and that was covered in old spruce, great big massive spruce, I'm told. But right now, it's as if someone took a razor and completely clear cut it because it's just sheared off. About 60 to 70, they figure, telephone poles and power poles were just snapped off. The noise, I guess, was incredible. And the old village site, the devastation is just simply unbelievable. The store that was down on the waterfront has a piece of ice in it that's the size of a semi-truck and trailer inside the store building.
What about the people in the community? What's the mood?
Well, the folks here are really positive. It's a very tight-knit community. But the tears are fairly close to the surface for many people also. They're still dealing with the trauma of it, and a lot of people, I think, are still a bit in shock that they've lost everything. And they're good at helping each other. Everyone here is helping as in any way they can, either by opening their homes to others, or there's a lot of cooking going on, both at the school. People can come to the school three times a day for meals. But there's also a lot of people in the community that are cooking up huge meals that didn't lose their homes because of flooding and just inviting whoever they see to come over and eat with them. So they're really helping each other out. But when you sit and talk to someone and they start to relay what happened that night, as I said, the tears are close to the surface. People cry about it. One resident here told me that they heard kids playing in the gym. They were sleeping in the school gym one night, about the fourth night after the flooding, and kids came in and started playing basketball. And when they first kind of woke up, she thought that it was the ice crushing the building. She panicked because the sounds were just so close in her mind that it started the panic for her all over again.
What is the state and federal help doing for the folks there?
Well, it's my understanding from talking to the VPSO, the Village Public Safety Officer, yesterday that the state troopers were here through the weekend and have been coming in and out. I haven't seen them. There is a trailer here at the school that's set up for an emergency command center. It's a DEC trailer. They're not there today. I was hoping that someone would be there today so that I could talk to them, but a couple folks here in town have told me that they were due to be in again either today or tomorrow, so it could be tomorrow. But a lot of people are feeling, of course, a great sense of urgency to get things done, and it's not really happening fast enough. They are just hearing about the fact that the governor has asked for a federal disaster declaration, but they don't know where that process is at. And as one resident here, John Borg, who's the retired postmaster, he's been here for 41 years, he said they need to get started because, later this month in June, the days start turning shorter again. And he said if they don't have things fairly well buttoned up by October, people that don't have homes right now aren't going to have their homes. And the village, the tribal council, they're going to identify sites in their subdivision in the new village area to let people have home sites and start clearing and putting down gravel pads for them. But as far as what type of assistance they'll have financially to rebuild, it's really up in the air right now. It's not known.
APRN's Lori Townsend is reporting from Eagle. The largest amount of undiscovered oil above the Arctic Circle is in Alaska waters. That's according to a new study from the U.S. Geological Survey that looks at the potential for finding oil and gas across the Arctic. The report was published in the journal Science last week. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The study took about 5 years to prepare and included input from scientists from all of the Arctic nations. Don Gauthier is a USGS geologist based in California who led the research. He says one of the biggest surprises is the likely overall amount of undiscovered oil in the Arctic.
I thought oil would have been more abundant than we estimate it to be.
But Gauthier says that doesn't mean the oil potential in the Arctic isn't considerable.
It's absolutely correct to say that in our judgment, the undiscovered oil resources in the Arctic, even if we turned out to be 100% correct and they were all found and developed, it still wouldn't in any way shift the global oil balance away from the producing areas of the Middle East, right? On the other hand, for the Arctic nations, the resources we're talking about here are quite significant.
And for Alaska and the U.S., the potential oil is substantial. The report estimates that close to one-third of the undiscovered Arctic oil is off Alaska's shores. That amounts to 28 billion barrels, or close to twice the amount of oil that has already been produced on the North Slope.
And that's a lot. And that's something like, in our judgment, something like 25% of the undiscovered oil in the Arctic is in that area of northern Alaska, you know, offshore, mainly offshore northern Alaska.
But Gauthier says undiscovered natural gas is much more abundant in the Arctic than oil.
The gas is, natural gas is heavily concentrated in Russian territory, in the South Kara Sea and in the Barents Sea. There's a lot of gas in Alaska as well, but especially in those areas of the Russian Arctic, it's quite extraordinary.
Most of the undiscovered petroleum in the Arctic is relatively close to shore, where Arctic countries have unambiguous ownership of the resources. Gauthier says that's an important finding in the report, but probably won't put an end to the political posturing in the Arctic.
Many people have been talking about international claims that the various countries have been making offshore. Remember, like a couple of years ago, the Russians with great flourish planted a flag out on the near the North Pole on the Lomonosov Ridge, and many people surmised that that was somehow related to claims of petroleum potential. But it turns out that most of the oil and gas is probably up in areas of settled national territory rather than international waters.
The environmental group Oceana is hoping the oil and gas assessment helps convince the U.S. to hold off on developing offshore resources in the Arctic. Jeffrey Short is the organization's Pacific Science Director. He says the amount of oil is not worth the environmental risk.
I was pretty underwhelmed with the amount of oil that was in the Arctic and even offshore of Alaska.
But Short says it's unfortunate that the most likely place to find oil off Alaska's coast is also one of the most environmentally sensitive areas of the Arctic. The Chukchi and Beaufort Seas are important habitat for the polar bear, walrus, humpback whale, and other species.
There's going to be potential for adverse interactions between the oil industry and production development and communities that depend on those biological ecosystems for subsistence and other resources.
The report will be an important tool for environmental organizations like Oceana, who are trying to build a case against offshore drilling. Gauthier says it will also be helpful for the oil industry and Arctic nations.
And it provides quite a nice planning tool for the various interests involved, you know, for the countries, for shipping, for transportation, for defense, you know, all the various interests that are operating and seem to be expanding the Arctic as the ice goes away will be served by being able to take a geographically based look at what the resource potential of the area is.
Because the study is estimating undiscovered resources, there's plenty of room for error. Gauthier says some of the most promising areas could turn out to be empty, and many parts of the Arctic could be prohibitively expensive to develop. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, encouraging diversity in the workplace in Anchorage.
What we want to see in an individual who does well in a diverse society is that they have a commitment to the idea of living with difference.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed, on the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
The more an organization embraces diversity, the more successful it is likely to be. That was the message of a Vancouver University professor and theologian who conducted a dialogue in Anchorage yesterday on race and diversity in the workplace. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Margot Bellamy helped organize Dr. Martin Brokenleg's week-long series of appearances in Anchorage. By Thursday, Bellamy could not have been more pleased with the results.
It's had the impact that we wanted. We did not want people to feel assaulted in any way with diversity. We wanted them to wanted it to be delivered in a way that make them be reflective and help them to be motivated to do whatever they want to do in terms of making our community a kinder, nicer, gentler place.
Bellamy directs the Anchorage School District's Office of Equal Employment Opportunity. She's actively involved in Anchorage's Community Diversity Project. The district is just one of several organizations and groups seeking to promote community dialogues on race and diversity. In the past, they sponsored panel discussions. This time, they decided to bring in an internationally recognized specialist who would address and facilitate various gatherings, classes, and work sessions. On Thursday afternoon, Brokenleg conducted a two-hour dialogue on race and diversity in the workplace in the Anchorage Assembly's meeting room at City Hall. It was packed. Brokenleg told the group, no matter whom they work for, a diverse organization enjoys practical rewards.
Whether that's religious diversity, racial diversity, age diversity, all of those qualities that are human differences, we actually have documentation that the offices that serve their purposes best are always diverse offices because they have a variety of viewpoints and a variety of skills and abilities in their office staff.
Brokenleg noted that for some of us, such workplaces can produce challenges.
What we want to see in an individual who does well in a diverse society is that they have a commitment to the idea of living with difference, that they understand themselves in reaction to the tensions that difference creates, because it always creates a degree of tension and discomfort, that they understand that they themselves are likely to be resistant to the change that diversity requires, and that they nonetheless are able to deal with the various conditions that their colleagues have. So we want to see a person who has broad social skills, but who is committed to this ideal, really in American society, that all people have a place and all people have a right to work well with one another.
Brokenleg is currently director of Native Ministries and professor of First Nations Theology and Ministry at the Vancouver School of Theology in Vancouver, British Columbia. For 30 years, he taught at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, as well as counseled students, served as a correctional institution chaplain, and participated in alcohol abuse counseling. He's conducted training programs throughout North America, including previous appearances in Anchorage, as well as in New Zealand and South Africa. Brokenleg is an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. The cornerstone of Brokenleg's approach to interrupting racism and antagonism toward diversity are honest, thoughtful relationships, no matter how much we may seek easier methods.
What we tend to do in the current technological explosion in American society is think that technique and technology will somehow handle all situations, but they can't handle human relationships. It's only humans reacting with one another and relating to one another that improve human relationships.
During the session, Brokenleg brought up the proposed and controversial Equal Opportunity Ordinance scheduled for public hearing at the Anchorage Assembly's June 9th meeting. The proposal would amend municipal code to include sexual orientation and veteran status, along with race, religion, age, and physical or mental disability. In the environment of Brokenleg's session, Some felt comfortable enough to express doubts about the ordinance change. Others responded politely. The discussion did not produce agreement. But Broken Leg would contend that just the fact it occurred and its tone was an important step to becoming a truly diverse community. This is Len Anderson.
A private company is taking another step in development of a wind farm near Delta Junction. Fairbanks-based Alaska Environmental Power began the project last year with the installation of a 100-kilowatt turbine. Managing partner Mike Kraft says a second, much larger unit will go up this summer.
It's going to be on a 240-foot tower, so this turbine is twice as tall, and it's actually nine times larger. And between the two turbines, as of September, we'll be at 1 megawatt.
That will make the facility as big as any other wind farm in the state, but well short of what Kraft and fellow investors have planned.
We would like to be able to move forward with a 15-megawatt facility. 15 megawatts would be about half of what they make at the Aurora Energy Plant downtown. And we would use 10 GE turbines to do that. They're 1.5 megawatt turbines. They're just a little bigger than the one we're putting in now. And be on our way to a full-scale commercial wind farm.
Kraft says the larger turbines will be spread over the company's 320-acre hilltop property outside Delta. The units would be massive, with blades that span 270 feet. Kraft says area residents have been supportive despite the impact to the local viewshed.
That's one of the reasons we like working in Delta, is that whole community sees the chance for economic development. I mean, imagine a $30 million project coming into your community.
Kraft says Delta is well-suited to the project due to the area's predictable wind regime.
There was a study done in 1952 by the federal government that tried to figure out just why it was so windy in Delta, because they were looking at their training facilities down there and concerned for their personnel and chill factors and so on. And one of the issues that came out of it was the meteorologists from the federal government realized that if you watch the barometric pressure in Northway and you compared it to the barometric pressure in Delta, whenever there was a 4 millibar differential, 4 hours later a wind event would start in Delta.
There's urgency to Alaska Environmental Power's plans due to a federal 30% capital rebate on wind turbine installations that expires after 2010. Kraft says he needs okays from the Golden Valley Electric Association, which buys the power, and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to move ahead on the project. GVEA Vice President of Transmission and Distribution Mike Wright says the utility supports the project with one potential worry.
The plus, obviously, is it's renewable energy, and it does offset the burning of oil in our case, because that's the most costly power. So that's the benefit. The concern is just that our job as electric utility is to make sure that people have reliable power. So we just have to ensure that a large turbine that can vary from moment to moment, that varying output of generation doesn't cause voltage flickering.
Wright says the Rail Belt power grid's limited production capacity makes it more susceptible to power fluctuations from any single generation point. He says it's possible a special generator will be necessary to compensate for vagaries of wind energy if regional wind generation increases substantially. The Delta project is one of several large wind projects on the horizon. Golden Valley is pursuing its own wind farm near Healy, and another is in the works for Fire Island near Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The 2009 commercial salmon season starts today in Lower Cook Inlet, and the forecast is calling for a slightly larger catch this year. A new management change is also affecting the harvest in some areas. KBBI's Marsha Lynn reports.
The entire Cook Inlet salmon fishery is split into two regions. Lee Hammerstram, area management biologist for Lower Cook Inlet, says catches differ in each area.
In Upper Cook Inlet, sockeye certainly rule there. They're the most numerous species in terms of the commercial catch. Lower Cook Inlet, we're not as blessed, unfortunately, with the natural systems that the sockeyes require. So the numbers are considerably less than Upper Cook Inlet. However, we do have a pretty large number of small pink salmon systems that cumulatively add up to a pretty good habitat for pinks, and therefore they are a very important species here in Lower Cook Inlet.
He gives the projected harvest figures.
We're forecasting a harvest overall of about 1.36 million fish this year, and that would be comprised primarily of approximately 1 million pink salmon and just over 300,000 sockeyes. Those are the two most important species that occur here in terms of numbers of fish.
Last year's total catch was 1.1 million fish, split more evenly between the two species. Commercial fishermen prize sockeye or red salmon because they fetch a higher price. Last year's average price for reds was $1.45 a pound, and for pinks it was 23 cents a pound, according to Hammerstram. He says it takes a while for the pace to pick up.
Tends to start out pretty slow here in Lower Cook Inlet, especially with just the set net fishery open. The set net catches are not all that great in Lower Cook Inlet. There's a pretty limited area where set gill netters are allowed to fish here, and the catches traditionally have been somewhat modest in that fishery. So I wouldn't expect any great catches here right out of the gate.
Managers assess salmon runs in season through aerial and field surveys. Hammerstram says they even use video recordings.
It is very interesting and very effective on these smaller clear water systems. We've actually been utilizing it for, seems like, about 7 years now, and we've been slowly expanding it to cover more systems and also refining it to improve the techniques.
ADF&G will announce fishery openings and closings through the 2009 commercial salmon season. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
The 31st annual King Salmon Derby in Haines ended Sunday with the closest win in memory. KHNS reporter Tara Bicknell has more.
Shel Skerritt, a former Derby winner, won this year's five-day event in Haines with a 33.9-pound Chinook landed in front of the old cannery in Letnikoff Cove. Derby chairman and president of the Haines Sportsman Association, Kim Larson, spoke to KHNS Monday.
From first place to second place, Mickey Gary had one that was 33.85, so .05 is the difference in first and second place. I think that's the closest since I've been running the Derby.
Skerritt, who has participated in the Haines Derby for almost a decade, won a cash prize of $2,600 plus a year's subscription to the Chilkat Valley News, a round of golf at Valley of the Eagles course, and an extra bonus prize for being a member of the Haines Sportsman's Association. He talked to KHNS Monday about his winning strategy.
We just drag the herring around just like everybody else. Everybody has their own technique and, you know, how your herring rolls in the water and the attractions and how deep, how fast the boat is. And just kind of a combination. And, of course, you've got to be in the right spot. And the right fish has to hit the herring. And I've seen a lot of fish lost right at the boat.
One of Skerritt's fishing partners, his son, Stephen, won the last King Derby in Haines in 2007. The father-son team has a unique good luck charm that's helped them win some kind of award every year since they began using it. Their secret, some say, is in the name of their 22-foot StarCraft boat.
Jane Byrne, yeah. Of course, that's Stephen's mother. So we're lucky. She made us a lucky boat.
Skerritt Sr. says this year's winning king was relatively small. The biggest Chinook he ever caught took second place 1 year at 42.65 pounds. This is Tara Bicknell in Haines.
Lecanti Glacier near Petersburg has advanced 300 feet, according to the results of this year's glacier survey by Petersburg High School students. The annual survey is led by a local science teacher who took six students to the site this year. KFSK's Alex Hotz has the story.
Most high school seniors spend their final weeks at school battling a severe case of senioritis. but for a select group of Petersburg students, that isn't the case. For 26 years, a small group of Petersburg High's upperclassmen have had the unique opportunity of conducting a survey on one of Southeast Alaska's most visited local landmarks, the LeConte Glacier.
LeConte Bay, as you go back, is a typical fjord, very, very deep, very, very steep-sided. As John Muir called it, it's Yosemite of Alaska.
Teacher Victor Troutman leads the survey team.
What happens is the students learn how to do the survey, then they do the mathematics, and then they plot it. I'm basically standing in the background making sure they apply all of their knowledge correctly, because it's probably in North America one of the longest studies on a single glacier that's done by high school students.
LeConte Glacier is a massive 21-mile long by 1-mile wide wall of ice at the head of LeConte Bay. In order to get to the top of the glacier, the students have to be flown in by Temsco helicopters. Stephanie Randrup is one of the students who participated in the survey.
I was on the north side, and me, Jake, and Caddy all set up a tripod on the north face, and we waited for the south side to collect their points, and then when they came over, we determined which points they had measured so we could measure the same points. And this way we could, like, it's like double-checking your work, and so we could see how far the glacier moved out.
Senior Jake Clemens said he enjoyed the surveying so much that he might pursue the subject in college.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about geology or glaciology in college, so this is pretty much what I'm into. I've seen them from, you know, distance from the water, but it's the first up-close and personal trip for sure.
As far as the survey results, Troutman says the students found LeConte has advanced slightly more than it did last year.
Basically, if you look at the most active portion of the glacier, it's about 300 feet beyond last year, which was in the same place as the year before, which is about 1,000 feet ahead of where it was the year before. So to put it kind of real in a nutshell, right now LeConte Glacier is not receding. It's either holding its own or actually coming out.
The LeConte Glacier is the southernmost tidewater glacier in the northern hemisphere. In 1993, LeConte receded over half a mile in a six-month period and continued to recede every year until 2000. From the years 2000 till 2006, it remained stationary. In Petersburg, I'm Alex Hotz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Alec Potts in Petersburg, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Marsha Lynn in Homer. APRN's Lori Townsend reported from Eagle. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.